moved his business into that scene. He's paying for at the kiosk. He's actually paying, getting a larger amount of space, as was Alibaba's Cafe, getting a larger amount of space. That was expanded last year, I believe. I know it was for Alibaba's Cafe. I think it also was for Sushi Now. But he is also getting a huge expansion. This area in front of the planter is going to be entirely brass roped off. There are going to be railings around there, according to our latest word from Mike DeGive and from the Downtown Association, from the City Council. There is going to be a railing in the area, and it's going to be such that only if you have the money will you be able to sit there. And not only that, I guess you also have to have the permission of these two store owners to use public space. Looks like we got a phone call coming in here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
So why don't they just go and, like, take their whole fucking hangout scene and go to the fucking parking lot now and claim it already, dude? Because they know that the next place they move to, if it's still on the fucking mall, they're just going to get moved from there. So why don't they just get fucking smart, the whole dirthead shit gang, and fucking go off the mall, dude? You know, they don't need to be there. It's not like they got business there. They fucking, you know what I mean? It's getting annoying, dude. I'm sick of seeing so many motherfuckers freaking hell hovering around that area, dude. It's like they're fucking, what's their purpose, dude? If they want to sell pot, why do they got to be out in the open, dude? They're only getting busted left and right. Most of them are just passing through town and fucking making it difficult for the fucking people that got to be homeless here, dude. Mm-hmm. They're not the homeless. You seem to think, Robert, that these people are homeless, but they're not, dude. They're fucking passing through and they're fucking shit up. They're getting people jumped. They're getting fucking, they're causing scenes, you know. And then the people that do have business here and know what to do on the mall scene can get it done, dude. But otherwise, you have to fucking move off the mall, dude.
No, I think the mall is for everybody.
No, dude, but what? No, dude. The mall's for fucking business, dude.
No.
Why do you go to Capitola Mall?
No, everybody. Capitola Mall is for people.
Well, what
with
do they want to be on the fucking mall for, Robert? What's their purpose?
Hey, what's your purpose in being on the
Why
mall?
Why am I being fucking? Because I'm sick of fucking having to go down there and fucking walk through.
No,
the
I'm
little,
saying when you go. Wait, caller.
Smelly
caller. Wait a minute.
Whoa.
When you go downtown, I mean, you know, sometimes you're there to buy something, sometimes you're there to walk around. You know, you got different purposes at different times, right?
No, dude, if you're going to be homeless and you're down there, you're going to be panhandling, supposedly, right?
No, there's...
But there's
no,
there's
you're
no
wrong.
Use panhandling
you're
in a group because nobody's going to
hey,
get you money if you're panhandling
what,
from a
what
group.
Are you so mad about?
Why am I so
yeah,
mad?
What are you so mad about?
Because I'm sick of going down there and fucking smelling them, and then if I do find out one day that my fucking marijuana connect isn't good, and I go down there thinking, all right, again, I'll drop my business level and go to somebody else. And then they go and they insult me with a fucking pinner fucking bag for 20 fucking bucks of Pretendica.
So your complaint like is you were ripped off in a dime bag.
I'm saying that
deal.
They're all fucking losers, dude.
Yeah.
The whole crowd of them, dude.
Oh,
they're not even fucking homeless, Robert.
Hey, I can't agree with
that. They're fucking, they're drifters
the
and they're fucked, dude.
Some
they're fucking it up for the homeless.
Hey, some of them are homeless. You know that, and
dude,
so do
you
I.
You know what? Next week, when your Sunday show, I'll have fucking people call in and tell homeless people that fucking are homeless in Santa Cruz and that are trying to get their shit together, and are trying to keep their social life together, who have just totally burned out on that whole fucking scene down there.
That's great. I mean, I appreciate that. Have them call in. I'd love to have them speak. And thank you for calling.
Right on.
All right.
A little devil's advocate, huh?
Why not?
All right, then.
Thank you. Yeah, the devil made me do it. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Any response to that last caller? He's telling us that what are these damn kids doing down there anyway? Why don't they just move to a parking lot? What's the story there, folks? Give a call to 427-3772 if you've got some answers. I don't really have a lot of answers, except I like to see these spaces kept open for everyone. And I see this is going to be closed. They're going to be essentially turned into business spaces. And I see the way to fight that is to tell the owners of these businesses who've done these deals, you're just not going to spend any money at your places until such time as you agree to a real conversation on this and really deal with your issues, not in a public way, not in some sort of secret back room, back doors deal. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Okay, so with a cooler head.
Hey, wait a minute now. You're
totally
Mr.
Clear.
Caller. What,
wait,
right,
just one more time. Just
right,
I
one more
I
time.
Can summarize just real quickly, and it won't even be but the other half of a sentence. But
okay.
I want to make sure, so you know, that I have nothing against the homeless. It's the
I didn't say you did.
It's the The derelicts I have a problem with. Those are the ones that are fucking it up for the homeless.
Dig it. Okay. Okay. Well, I understand your feeling.
Let me make that big difference.
Okay.
The difference between a homeless and a derelict is a homeless person has to sleep outside. A derelict doesn't give a fuck what happens to his surroundings.
Thanks, caller. I got
you. All right.
Of course, I'm concerned with derelict businesses who like to blame homeless people and other people for the failure of their businesses. And I don't think that's fair either. We're in an economic recession, and it's very nice to blame the people on the bottom for those painful problems of the people at the top. However, we know, in fact, that those problems come from the way they're setting things up, the way they're distributing things, and the way things are going in that way, instead of choosing the convenient scapegoats and jumping on the war wagon as they would have us do. And I think this war wagon against poor people, because that's what it is. The caller who called in has some concerns, and frankly, I'd rather deal with his concerns and try to address the more deep-seated business bigotry that I think is behind this whole notion of privatizing the mall. And I don't think it's going to be good for any of us. I'm positive it's not good for any of us. And the only question is can we fight it, and can we fight it effectively? I think it's important that the City Council and the Downtown Association and the two businesses that are doing this know that this will not come without a cost. And the cost will be that they cannot maintain the fantasy that they're engaging in some sort of open community and welcoming downtown, that this is an attempt to run off a bunch of people. And if you think they're derelicts and bums and bad drug salesmen, as our last caller did to some extent, then perhaps you feel it's a good idea. I don't see that in the scene primarily. I mean, I'm sure there's some of that happening. Some of that happening, I'm sure, everywhere, inside houses, down on the boardwalk, anywhere else you want to look. But I think that generally we need to have open sidewalks, open process, open doors. You know, I mean, obviously there are exceptions to that in different cases, but this is not one of those cases or times. There hasn't been the kind of public dialogue that would allow that. So we got a lot of stuff coming up on the agenda here today, so to speak, the Bathrobes Piers Broadsides agenda. I'm particularly looking forward to a conversation with public defender Charlie Stevens. This is an attorney who works for the public defender's office, who contacted me this afternoon and told me that he was happy to be on the air as a guest by phone. He can't come in. He's got to take care of a child, and so he's also been working all day at the courts. Just surviving at the courts is a full-time job as far as I'm concerned. Every time you have to go through those metal detectors, to me it's another humiliation, although most people don't seem to notice it anymore. I am really going to be glad to have him on the air, and I'm going to be calling him after we do this segment on the interview in Santa Barbara with Glenn Maurer, as I said, who's been defending homeless people charged with camping in a vehicle down there, actually habitating a vehicle. But first, this call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Okay, I got 30 seconds.
It'll
give you something to talk about, because I'd like an answer to a question.
Okay.
Do you think that or agree that the derelicts among the homeless, if the homeless policed those individuals out and ran them off, that the homeless situation could take on a progressive air.
Okay, I'll try and answer that question on the air, caller.
Okay. You can answer it, yeah, on the air.
All right, sure.
Okay, the answer to that question is, for me, it's an important question. It's always asked, because you get people who are camping in a campground, you're going to get some drunks, you're going to get some rather abusive folks, you're going to get some violent folks, you're going to get some crazy folks. You're going to get people who are, you know, not your A1 shopping material, and also people who often are not the best companions or roommates. You know, I mean, let's be honest about this. My response is this. People go through different phases in their lives. You know, I don't think that any of us can say that we've always been on top all the time. And I think that you fall down sometimes. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't people who aren't dangerous under certain circumstances or disagreeable in some profound and long-lived kind of way, or people I would choose not to associate with. But the difference between a public space and a private space is, in a private space, you can play these private club games. It used to be you could, you know, tell blacks to leave, you could tell Hispanics to leave, you could tell Chinese to leave, tell Native Americans, get the fuck out. That's what private spaces are like. You can tell people without money, get out of my place. Well, Then there are the public spaces that say all of us are born with certain inalienable rights. And one of those rights is indeed the right to be in a public space, provided we're not being abusive or assaultive, provided we're not engaging in overt kinds of criminal behavior. We have the right to be there. And to transform the mall into a place of private spaces is like transforming the town into a place of high rents. Sort of seems similar to me. You get a certain class of moneyed people, but you lose something profoundly too. Now, the other question the caller had was, well, what about, let's say, a homeless community? Wouldn't it be better for them to drive out the folks that are giving them a bad name or that are the losers? Again, I don't like these categories because I don't think they really reflect real people. They reflect one person's perception of another person at any particular time. And I'm not going to go any further into this dialogue at this time with this caller because I've got to get into this interview, or I'm not going to get through this show. So I'm going to apologize right now for not doing this, and I'm going to begin this interview with Glenn Maurer, and we're going to talk after the interview a bit about the necessity defense and a bit about, we're going to have some interviews with some conversations with Charlie Stevens, who has been a public defender and has actually used the necessity defense in various cases, at least one case I know of. Let me review for you what the Santa Barbara situation is. Santa Barbara is... There are two cases that have successfully been appealed by attorney Glenn Maurer in a situation where they were camping in vehicles, they were living in vehicles, they had no choices, and they were approached by police officers, told they had to leave, told they actually just ticketed, they weren't told they had to leave, but they were ticketed and then told they had to leave, but they had no place to go to, and they were told that they shouldn't have been there because they could have gone to the rescue mission that night. And we're going to talk more about that. Now, the first half of this interview was played before, and what the court decided was that the rescue mission in Santa Barbara, because it has religious tests, because if you are required, let's say, to sit through a prayer session, required to segregate by sex, required not to touch, if there's a series of religious, particularly, more specifically, though, the whole prayer business, if you're required to do that, then the government can't really send you there and say, you go there or we're going to arrest you for sleeping somewhere else. They just can't do that. And what you're going to hear this where we join this conversation in the Santa Barbara interview with Glenn Maurer is at a point where we're talking about the city's determination to discriminatory enforcement of laws, how some people who are wealthier get off well, whereas others are caught up in the toils of these laws. Let's hear this long-lost interview at long last. And caller, hang on, I'll talk to you off-air here.
I mean, what it does is it makes it criminal to park an RV for any purpose on RV streets, I mean on the public streets, even when you're engaging in business that has nothing to do with habitation.
If the vehicle was never, if you had no food and no clothing and no anything in the vehicle and you were just using it as a commuter car or something like that, I'm not sure that it would apply.
Uh-huh.
But absolutely, if you go down to the beach in Santa Barbara, in parking lots, or anywhere, and you see all these out-of-state plates and these big fancy, Class A motorhomes, you know darn well these people are habitating those vehicles.
Uh-huh.
And they pull in the parking lots, and they stay there for a day or two, a day, and then they drive out. But during the time they're there, they're habitating that vehicle just as our clients are.
Maybe you need a homeless...
Versus sleeping.
Homeless ticketing.
If the law was against sleeping, that would be a different issue.
Right. I think you need a homeless ticketing squad to go down there and start getting these lawbreakers, these relatively wealthier lawbreaker folks.
Probably these people would just pay the fine and move on.
But I mean, again, one would think that they don't even pay a fine if a fancy recreational vehicle parks downtown in order to go purchase some stuff, and yet at the same time, they've got a rumpled bed or something. Police officers, I don't think, are going to bother them. And even if they're,
you walk by and you'll see these big rigs up on their jacks with their antennas up, clearly get their little front porch open and a little mat at the step,
Mm-hmm.
And they never get tickets. They don't give them tickets.
Have you actually done surveys on that? I mean, do we have any objective?
I've taken photographs of vehicles all over the city that are there on a regular basis. I've got one right down the street from me right now that comes every year.
Mm-hmm.
In my neighborhood, it's people from Washington State place. It's obviously probably grandparents, I don't know, relatives of the people who live there. And this vehicle comes in and it squeezes itself up onto the drive.
to show selective prosecution or selective enforcement.
It could be. There's a huge burden of proof to show intent that they do this willfully. I've thought about ways of doing that. Maybe getting discovery and getting the citations and showing that they only give citations to old vehicles, and maybe there'd be some inference that the old vehicles are more likely to belong to the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that would overcome the burden of proof.
When we talked to you last, the city's rent recent vacancy rate down in Santa Barbara, there was a 1% with one bedroom rooms going for 1,100 one bedroom units.
900 to 1,100, yes.
And your rent increases were 20% the year before until into 2001. Situation still as bad as it was?
It's getting just slightly better as the economy goes bad. But let me tell you what the health department said about Santa Barbara's situation.
Sure.
Part of the fun I had in this trial was I found a city ordinance that the city had enacted on this subject, and I've used that against the city, and it's quoted in the opinion. Let me read what it says. The city of Santa Barbara has declared, quote, there is a critical shortage of low and moderate income housing within the city and the south coast of Santa Barbara County, unquote, in the Santa Barbara Municipal Code, Section 2608-0208. That's the section that exists in our code for another purpose, but it's valuable. Expert testimony established that there is a shortage of low-rent housing for people with low and moderate income in the south coast areas of Santa Barbara County, and available housing has decreased over the last 5 years with a vacancy rate of less than 1%. The federal government provides housing subsidies for low-income residents referred to as Section 8 housing, in which the resident pays a percentage of their adjusted household income towards rent, and the local housing authority pays the balance up to a housing and urban development determined fair market rent. At the time of the trial, there were 3,000 households on a waiting list for Section 8 housing with an average wait of 2 to 3 years. Testimony at trial established that a one-bedroom apartment could be rented in the city of Santa Barbara for about $1,000 per month. Since most landlords require first and last month's rent plus a security deposit, it takes from $3,000 to $4,000 to move in. To afford the apartment would take, ideally, an annual gross income of $36,000. It is impossible to afford an apartment strictly on federal disability payments, since the rental amount is approximately 125% of such payments. Approximately 5 to 6 years ago, there were about 500 single-room occupancy hotels available in the city when the residents could rent a room and share a bathroom. At the time of defendant's citation, only the Faulding Hotel remained with a total of 89 rooms. Although public housing is available in the city of Santa Barbara, it has a waiting list of 5 years. That was the summary of the evidence that we presented on housing.
And that was quoted by the appellate judges.
What I read was from the opinion.
Mm-hmm. So this case concerned both the Cooper Mobley case and also a second case?
Ridley. David Ridley. Same situation.
That's the street juggler fellow?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
He was acquitted because there was no room at the mission for him, but she was convicted. Again, the commissioner apparently assumed. So the evidence was stronger. They were found in their vehicle in the evening after dark with the TV on, and they clearly were living in the vehicle, and there wasn't any quarrel about where they were at the time.
This is his partner?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But she's also disabled. And part of the evidence in that case, again, was that forcing them to separate and not care for each other, and him not to care for her, is unreasonable.
And they were using that the rescue mission was open was the basis for their denying the necessity defense applied?
Yes.
And the Superior Court decision, an 11-page decision by two out of the three justices or judges?
Well, three of the judges agreed that necessity defense was proven in both cases. One of the judges said, we don't need to reach the issue of whether the First Amendment religious issue needs to be resolved because we went on necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to go that far.
To just went a page too far, huh?
Well, two of them wanted to reach the religious issue, and they did.
And you actually had the help of the ACLU and a friend of the court brief there?
Yeah, the ACLU requested and they filed the amicus brief on the First Amendment issue.
So where does that leave your the other cases? Are you have any other cases on appeal, or is that new?
Nothing else on appeal. These cases have been certified to the second district for publication, and I'm not quite sure what the process of that is, but I think that they're not, the appellate court does not deny them certification, either by taking them up for argument themselves or by sending them back to the appellate department in the Superior Court. They will end up being published. If they end up being published, they become authority to be cited statewide and can be used by others.
Even in Santa Cruz?
Even in Santa Cruz.
Now, when will we know if that's going to happen?
I think it's 30 days from the date of publication, which was December 19th, but I'm not sure on that.
Now, I believe Tobe was originally depublished before it reached the Supreme Court, right?
Well, we'll take one thing at a time. I'm hoping it's going to be published. If they give us a chance to argue it again in the Court of Appeals, I mean, there's a risk in that because this language is so good on most issues, certainly on the necessity part and on the First Amendment part, it's very good. I'm unhappy with the language about habitation, but I'd certainly take it as it's written rather than lose it all.
Mm-hmm. So we'll know on the 19th if this is going to become...
I mean, that's correct. I'm not, you know, I should know better, but I don't know for sure what the timeline is.
Right. But we might know by then what whether it's going to be, I guess, ruling precedent in Santa Barbara and then persuasive precedent elsewhere in the state?
Well, it can be cited elsewhere for whatever authority they want to give to it. But it definitely is authority in Santa Barbara right now, unless somebody changed the opinion. Within the county of Santa Barbara, it is law.
And I learned from conversations with Glenn Maurer in the last few days that the decision was not published, and therefore it is only law in Santa Barbara. However, it is still very inspirational to those of us up here who are watching attorneys like Chris Fredrickson and others preparing the appeal for the Camp Paradise 3, who themselves were in a situation of self-evident necessity, which was politically denied by Commissioner Irwin Joseph because of what seemed to me to be transparent political concerns. He didn't actually offer any other alternatives to the Camp Paradise people. He knew that the Camp Paradise situation was such that there was no shelter on August 3rd when those tickets were issued. Even there were signed letters from service providers saying there hasn't been any shelter, there won't be any shelter, there ain't any shelter. And yet, he somehow thought that they should have found somewhere else to go, even though he had no specifics about this. So anyway, that's being applied down here we're drawing some courage from the activities of Glenn Maurer in Santa Barbara. Let's hear some more of this conversation, which was recorded about 3 weeks ago in a phone call on, the issue of this very successful and very encouraging court decision in the Cooper and Ridley cases. There we go.
And has that had much of an effect in the last few weeks?
Well, the biggest effect is not directly a result of these opinions, but it's a result of the work we've been doing and the success I've had in these trials. The city of Santa Barbara, the city attorney's office, is trying to run an end run on this whole thing. I'm tired of losing the trial court. They've gone to the city council with a suggestion that a new law be enacted, which simply controls parking of recreational vehicles. Would make it illegal to park the recreational vehicles in anywhere in the city between 4 and 6 a.m. On the streets. So they could just go out and write a ticket on the vehicle that they found parked on the city street.
And that's an administrative rather than a judicial process at the lower level, right?
Right, the traffic parking tickets is a real pain in the ass.
So while you don't have much in the way of protections even for infraction cases because you haven't got a public defender and you haven't got a jury trial option, you still at least have the hope that an attorney like yourself will come in and you can argue it before a judge, whereas this new parking ticket deal means you have to post bail first, go before through an administrative process, and you want to outline how that would work?
Yeah, what happens is first of all, you can call the city police agency that issued the ticket and ask them to do an administrative review to see if it was properly issued. That's sort of like.
And there's a brief pause for technical activity while we turn over the tape and proceed. But have no fear, we're going to be right back. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Robert Norse. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz. And we're listening to a conversation with Glenn Maurer, the former public defender of Santa Barbara, who now works with the Committee for Social Justice, the legal project of the Committee for Social Justice, and has been successfully winning one ticket after another for homeless folks down there. And I think we are almost ready to continue playing this tape. And it should be coming back online soon.
Okay, we're on again. Hang on.
And you have all these proposed restrictions on RVs, and I guess you said there's some sort of a citywide restriction that they're now planning as well?
The one I mentioned was to make, well, presently it's illegal to park an RV or a large truck on a residential street between, I think it's 4 and 6 a.m., 2-hour period, maybe between 3 and 5, but it's sometime in that period of time, midnight, mid-evening, during the nighttime hours. It's not really enforced unless somebody complains, but this would extend that now to the industrial and commercial zones as well. So it would be illegal to park anywhere, an RV anywhere on the city streets between those 2 hours.
Has there been some kind of big crisis? I know that there was, seven or eight months ago, Fess Parker allowed a bunch of homeless people to sleep on his property for a while, and that I heard that they actually did a fairly good job of it, and they kept a fairly clean camp, but that it, you know, eventually was swept away by police. But has there been some kind of reason for this, other than simply trying to avoid your success in court?
Who knows? What, you know, we have pushed down for a year this initiative that you mentioned to create some alternatives. We got the city council to at least say they will allow church parking lots to allow up to three vehicles on the lot with permission of the churches, and so that is a potential solution, but it's really a minor.
No, we have had it here for about 6 years and it hasn't had a big impact.
It's just almost impossible to think that there's going to be enough churches that would do this. We've asked the city to use some of its own lots. There's a tremendous amount of resistance to this, which is unclear to me as to why the city does not want to designate any of its own lots for such use.
Same here in Santa Cruz. The police chief declared he could not provide security on the police department lot at night.
And then we had some commercial people who offered to let people use their lots. The city hasn't done that, and they claim it's because of coastal zone rules about how properties are used, how difficult it is. We think that that's a bit of a bit specious, that there's a way around it, a simple one-stroke kind of way around it.
Mm-hmm.
But and then we've had talk about building or designating some large lot that the city would operate through, or cooperating with a nonprofit or some other group to run. That one seems to be the most attractive to politicians. Probably the least attractive to me in terms of long-term negative issues. But anyway,
why would that be?
Well, because I think those kind of concentrations of people that create the negative reactions from community groups.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a dispersed kind of population of two or three people, dispersed around the city and county, I think it just goes away. It all goes away.
It is also mentioned in the recent rather extensive Santa Barbara News Press story about police ticketing 20 RVs in the middle of the night.
Yes, they put the news limits up on the parking lot, right?
Yeah, the Garden Street Visitor Center on Cabrillo, using, stopping at night, beeping their horns, flashing their lights, using a loudspeaker to yell, "This is a warning, we'll be back in half an hour," against people, one of whom is described as a 49-year-old disabled man, Gregory Lopez, who, along with Teresa Carina, again, according to the same story, who two of them lived there with their newborn baby, or her newborn baby, were requesting an official police review of the $30 parking tickets they were getting under the no parking to 3 a.m.
Giving them some advice about how to do that.
And how's that going?
I don't know. I haven't heard any updates.
Have they been harassed since? I mean, have they disappeared?
I haven't heard any mass ticketing since that time, no.
And what do people do after this? Do they move, or do they just... sit there and wait for the next blow.
I've gone down to look at the lot, and there are vehicles in it, so I'm not quite sure if it's... The thing about this lot, we don't need to get into local facts, but this lot was unused at those hours, and in the summer there are restricted times for the lot, but in the winter there's not, and the folks have gone in there because it appears that you could spend up to 24 hours in the lot without problem. There was no charge, and then all of a sudden they decided they would put these new signs up, and they put up three signs at the back of the lot. There's an argument that the signs are not sufficient notice, and that it isn't clear what part of the lot they apply to. So there's some problems about it. And these cases are subject to being reviewed in court. And one of the issues that I will raise is if we go to court on it, probably I'll bring in the city engineer who was given the authority to post these signs and find out why he posted them. And I suspect he posted them not because there was a problem of access or safety or anything, because the city police told him they didn't like these people saying it. I'm not quite sure that that's a proper basis for posting signs.
Well, I know that here in Santa Cruz, they followed the example of homeless people in Santa Barbara who formed an organization called Homes on Wheels about 6 or 7 years ago under the leadership of Nancy McCready and Susan Dunn, when I guess your city officials began to post signs under the freeways about these 3 to 5 no parking at night signs, specifically designed apparently to get rid of homeless folks who are parking in vehicles down there. And here in Santa Cruz, Homes on Wheels formed because of this local Santa Cruz councilwoman's measure to criminalize parking on streets. They declared that there was going to be street sweeping every night, every morning, which doesn't happen anywhere else in Santa Cruz, and that folks could not park, I think it's between 5 and 7 on the streets, and they'd have to move. But it was clearly done immediately after complaints about homeless people living there and kind of scapegoating of homeless people. And it drove people out. People were no longer in that area. And it also resulted in the confiscation and towing of a number of vehicles. In fact, some claim that there's kind of a racket that the local police in league with, or having a cozy relationship with North County Tow. That is yet to be, established, with a lot of documentary evidence. But that certainly created a lot of resentment here. Have you had a lot of vehicles towed down there? Is that happening?
I don't know if any RVs have been towed. I'm not saying they haven't, but I'm not sure of any. I'm not know of any. We had a couple cars towed, but that was because it didn't have registration.
That can happen, I think, more and more as the insurance requirements and registration requirements become difficult for folks to meet who are living in vehicles. And I know that as an attorney, that puts you in a difficult position because, well, as a human being, you may sympathize with folks who need a place to live. You acknowledge you're kind of left with few legal alternatives if they can't legally register their vehicle, right? What's kind of next on the horizon? I know you have, a city council meeting coming up, and a board of supervisors was doing something around these issues, too.
Board of supervisors staff, county staff working on trying to create some county proposed alternatives, including maybe a large site and use of county lots or other lots in the county dispersed around the county. Then we've got there's no return date on that, but that's sort of in the works. We have a staff person that meets with us and helps. And we have the city, we have a new city council, basically, of newly elected people. We believe that this is reset now for the 29th of January for action. And we've been trying to meet with the newly elected members of the city council and brief them on what has happened today so that they don't walk in and blindsided by the city staff position that may not represent the history.
Santa Barbara actually has a process by which citizens can initiate items, put them on the city council agenda. I know that's what I was told several years ago.
Yes.
We don't have that here in Santa Cruz, even though Santa Barbara is a larger city. It's interesting that you have, I guess, theoretically somewhat more democratic access, and that homeless people have on occasion used that access. So all of this affects people in their vehicles, but ironically, the number of people who live in their vehicles is significantly less and a smaller percentage of the homeless population than those who live outside their vehicles. What's happening with them? And what's the legal situation?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to say what you just said here. I can't say that's true or not true.
I think it's pretty much true here, but maybe it's not true.
It may not. It may be, but the depending on how you define homeless people, I mean, there's a huge percentage of quote-unquote people who would otherwise be homeless but are living, you know, 10 and 15 to a room in houses and apartments that they rent.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly these are Mexican nationals.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a, you know, these are people who really ought to really have a home. They just have a place to crash at night. It's in violation of the ordinances and city zoning laws, but nobody does much about that. Then we have RV people.
Well, you wouldn't want to drive away your cheap labor there.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
That is bizarre. Then we have the RV people, and some people who sleep in cars but seem to be discreet about it and don't get excited, or at least I don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm not quite sure. We haven't got an encampment right now. At one point, there were substantial numbers of people along behind the zoo there, as you know,
mm-hmm.
in the bushes, but they came in and the railroad came in on a railroad property and cleaned out most of the vegetation. I think there's a few camps there I've seen, but not many.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a sense of how many non-RV street homeless there are.
Mm-hmm. And most of your cases, well, you do. Majority of your cases involve, well, they don't involve specifically sleeping and camping, right? That's about half your, but a little less than half your cases, or?
No, I think about three quarters of the cases involve camping.
And those are mostly folks who camp in their vehicles.
Right, cars and RVs.
And is that because you think that, you know, you've acquired a reputation for success in those areas, or have other people come to you as well saying, look, I slept outside and they hassled me, and, I mean, are you getting all
cases? I know is the people who sleep rough are more transient, maybe more loaning, maybe more loners. I don't know what the reason might be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe fewer of them. I had a good many of them when the park, well, when that area described by the railroad tracks was more vegetated, you know, when there was more shelter there.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good many people came to us in those cases, and we won those cases by and large because the city was trying to enforce the city laws on railroad property.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped that.
That happened in Buena Park too, where they tried to try a 60, I don't know, 75-year-old woman, Miss Grew, for, you know, camping under misdemeanor camping law, would have given her 6 months in jail. And they showed through.
Right, I
remember that case.
Mine.
It was railroad property and not city property. What's happening with, I guess I'm going to throw a couple of quick questions out at you, and you've been really very patient with us. We've been talking with Glenn Maurer, who's sort of the one-man legal team for the homeless community in Santa Barbara, pro bono. Thank you very much, Glenn, for doing that. We had a thing called the Hank Show that used to be feeding people on Sundays, sort of a religious but food-oriented situation in the park down there by the beach. Is that still going on?
I'm not familiar.
I know that they were trying to drive them away. I'm just trying to kind of throw a few out at you. You know,
Aaron would probably know more about these things than I do.
Yeah, I think I probably will try that later. You are also running for Attorney General for the state of California on the Green Party ticket, as I mentioned before. Did they come and draft you because of your good reputation for defending the homeless?
I was drafted. I certainly did appreciate it. I'm on the, I had signatures gathered on my behalf around the state. We were qualified to be on the ballot. We'd be on the primary ballot. I would be on the primary ballot unopposed. At one time we thought there might be opposition. So there will be no other. I mean, unless something strange happens, I will be on the fall ballot as a Green Party candidate for sure.
Do you have any Green Party members on city council? Yeah, you won, apparently almost won, but didn't.
No, John Strawn ran here, but they came very close.
Anybody, Green Party endorse any other members of the council?
No, there's no Green Party person on the council right now.
I've been very... almost adulatory toward your work, and because I am very impressed with it and pleased that you're doing it. But of course, my experience with the Green Party in Santa Cruz and statewide, in terms of politicians in office, and I mentioned this to you before the interview, has been very bad. And I'm always kind of I always get kind of regarded as sort of a death sentence when I see people getting involved as politicians in Green Party politics, and that's just my perspective. But, you know, I've talked to you about how in Arcata we have, you know, a city council majority that, according to homeless people, we're, you know, engaging continuing restrictions under the camping ordinance up there when the state Green Party platform asks for an end to all, you know, anti-homeless laws, specifically laws of bars, sleeping, and camping, particularly in areas where there's no adequate shelter. In Santa Cruz, we have the infamous Mayor Fitzmaurice. He's now just a council member, but he's still on the council, who was notoriously supportive of the sleeping ban. Of course, I've talked to you about Michael Feinstein down in Santa Monica, who is angered and disappointed a lot of homeless activists down there. I'm not saying that it isn't different in city to city. I mean, you know, you're in a particular situation in Santa Barbara, but what do you think? Is the success going to spoil Glenn Maurer?
Well, I'm not going to win the
so I don't.
So you won't win, so it won't be a problem.
I don't think that's a danger. Right. Well, I mean, and I guess, you know, for those of us, I've actually found the Green Party in Santa Cruz has gotten better in the last.
Well, I don't want to stand here. I mean, my silence about your comments about the Green Party doesn't mean I necessarily agree with it. I mean,
right.
Of the choices available to the public in terms of who are concerned with social justice issues, there is no comparison. The Green Party, you know, is the only one that promises activity and action that's sympathetic to the needs of the poor and others who are being left out of our society. And whether you're happy or not happy with individuals, I mean, are you happy with George Bush or were you happy with Al Gore? I mean, who do you choose? You think Gray Davis is an admirable state leader in terms of his sympathy for the poor and for the people who have been left out behind by society?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what choice do you want to have?
Well, the problem we have in Santa Cruz is holding Green Party politicians accountable. They just, I mean, local politicians, not, you know, I'm not talking about folks, you know.
I know nothing about the individual politics of any of these people you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, all politics is the art of the possible, and you have to do what is possible. Do and not expect people to do what it's impossible to do.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Well, you're doing the impossible, and I'm pleased to see it.
Well, it's not impossible because it got done.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have gotten done if you hadn't done it. I can tell you that right now.
Well, I enjoy doing it, and I feel good about doing it.
Anything you want to kind of round this up with? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot we have not really. Well, here's one question for you. Since September 11th, there has been a significant government expenditure into police and military functions and a lot of concern about civil rights violations, civil liberties violations, I should say, for not just for non-citizens, but for citizens as well. Has this, in your view, had any impact on homeless people in your area?
I haven't seen any direct impact except that there's this, you know, thin and patently false rationalization that we now have we have reason now to exercise more control and over folks and have more government information about individuals. I mean, it's just patently absurd, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, the forces that want this will find any reason they can to establish it. I haven't seen any ordinances or actions in our local government area that are specifically responsive to that.
Mm-hmm. So the police are not getting a more favorable treatment from the city council or the board of supervisors because of the crisis?
As far as I can tell, the police have never been denied what they want from those agencies.
The same here in Santa Cruz.
I mean, I don't think that's new. It's just the way it is. Most of our politicians are endorsed, elected politicians are endorsed by the police agencies, and therefore they're a little bit unwilling to bite the hand that is endorsed and provide them with huge amounts of money as campaign contributions.
But you as Attorney General will be different because you're not endorsed by the police agencies.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I find so offensive about the state of California, and one of the things will be on my campaign list of things to do, is I would convene a commission to take testimony and consider why California continues to build prisons at such a high rate at the time one of the lowest crime rates we have ever had, a declining prison population. And I think it's pretty clearly, my suspicion is the reason for the commission to be oriented would be that I think there's an unholy alliance between big business and builds prisons that has huge profits. And the Correctional Guards Association gives huge amounts of money to Gray Davis and other politicians in return for increased benefits and, you know, hugely, extremely well-paid positions.
You're attacking the builders of the affordable housing of tomorrow, you know.
Well, that's what it is. I mean, ironically, we've got the only retirement program for most poor people is go to prison.
Hey, it's three hots in a cot, man.
Yeah, many of our clients get those first two strikes in, so when you need to retire, you get that third strike and have a place to spend the night.
You know, nationally, statewide, there's a group called the California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project, which I've been rather critical of, but a lot of us have been concerned about the 647J, once known as 647I, which is a state anti-homeless, anti-lodging law, which comes out of an 1872 ordinance. I suspect it may have been originally intended against blacks, frankly, but I don't know, which says that if you, you know, essentially it's the basis by which some jurisdictions, Clovis, Santa Ana, Sacramento, other places go after homeless people. It's a sleeping ban, fundamentally. As Attorney General, when you are elected, let's be optimistic, will you refuse to enforce this ordinance? What will you do about this kind
of... Well, I can't. As Attorney General, you don't enforce local ordinances on a local level. So what
this is a statewide ordinance.
The Attorney General doesn't have the local district attorney to it. But, almost specifically in response to your question, on the list of things that I have as a platform, I would convene the Attorney General has the power to call all district attorneys, sheriffs, and chiefs of police together to convene and discuss issues of statewide prosecution. And I would convene such a committee and ask them, in fact, order them to create some type of uniformity about prosecutorial standards around the state and decide what's worth the resources and effort to prosecute and what isn't. So we wouldn't have this variety where, as you mentioned, in some counties they enforce this misdemeanor penal code section and other counties ignore it completely.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have some uniformity. And then as Attorney General, you do have the responsibility to handle appeals. And on that level, you know, I would exercise substantial discretion. I wouldn't necessarily appeal and defend a conviction in the trial court simply because the district attorney's office got this conviction and wants it sustained.
Mm-hmm.
I would make an independent call about whether it's just to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have some serious, like, for example, one of the things that I would do with every three-strike conviction, whether they're already sentenced, on appeal, would be reviewed by our staff, and we would decide if that conviction is arguably cruel and unusual punishment, you know, grossly excessive punishment for the incident that caused the conviction. And in any case where we decide that there's cruel and unusual punishment, we would petition the appellate courts to reverse the sentence and sentence the defendant under the non-three strikes criteria.
And I guess, finally, although I'm not sure how final, I've been going final for the last few questions. For homeless people who don't have access to an attorney, and here in Santa Cruz, that's almost everybody, any tips or recommendations for defending yourself in using a necessity defense? I'm actually trying to put together a flyer that cites the elements of a necessity defense, and I'm kind of hopeful of putting it out so that folks can at least make that attempt. I know that a lot of the defense you've done in court hasn't been necessity defense, but has pointed out just sort of, you know, failure to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, failure to make even a case initially, technical difficulties in the citations and so forth. And all these things really require just close examination of the law that, you know, that you're being charged with by going to the law library, reading the law, carefully looking at past cases. But, of course, for a lot of people who haven't had legal experience, that's quite a trial, and if you're homeless, it's an additional burden. But just going into court and trying to get a necessity defense, any just sort of tips for people on how to proceed on that?
Well, I think you've got the elements that we went through earlier. A person needs to understand that a defense is not part of the prosecution's burden, it's part of their burden to produce that evidence. But they don't want to help the prosecution by offering evidence that undercuts that. Either they don't ask questions at all, or they ask too many questions, and, you know, they ring a bell that can't be unrung. You have to understand the process of the trial, and it's not what people think it is. You know, the prosecution has to make a showing that when they rest and stop their case, they finish their case, and no more evidence is being presented. At that point, they have to have enough evidence to sustain that conviction on an appeal. So you have a right at that point to say, I don't think the evidence they've offered is sufficient to prove the crime, because, for example, using the case that I mentioned earlier today, we have a person who was charged with camping, and all they actually showed was that she was sleeping. And I argued that they hadn't met their burden.
Now, in Santa Cruz, sleeping is equivalent to camping, but not in Santa Barbara.
But it has to be, no.
Yeah.
It's sleeping and camping in the county ordinance are both part of the same county ordinance. But the charge against this particular defendant was that she was camping because the officer wrote on the citation that she was camping. Even though he cited the citation, county citation ordinance number, which includes sleeping, he wrote camping. The complaint, the form of the charging document is a citation unless they file a complaint. So what it says on the face of the citation is what you are defending against. My argument was that she was only defending against camping, not against
sleeping.
Mm-hmm. And it was unfair for them to not want to change it and charge her with sleeping when she hasn't been given notice about that when she walked into court. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is these are technical to a degree, but most folks would not understand that. But you do have to, there's this moment when people rest their case that they have proved it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can go forward with your own case. Most people don't understand how to do that. They don't understand that they're under oath. They have to testify, not just give a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have to tell relevant issues to the case, not explain why the punishment should be smaller or lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of they have to know when they've ended their presentation of evidence. And it's between that and when they want to argue something beyond it.
Have you ever considered writing anything for...
We're trying to help people by preparing some documentation on how to fight these parking tickets, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more doable because it's a little clearer. All we can do, though, is give them the procedural outline. The strategic process about how you do it is almost dependent on every case.
Right. You know what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to try to drop some tips myself, send them down to you for your thoughts. And kind of circulate them, because I know that what you're saying is quite true, but it's also true that you can be better prepared in these circumstances, and you can mount a case. And I think your success with the necessity defense down there, as well as success in Albany, California, and I think it's been used elsewhere successfully. Camp Paradise case is on appeal. He, of course, denied the necessity defense here. Our Commissioner Joseph denied that it was...
I did speak with the trial lawyer in that case before the trial.
Mm-hmm. That was probably Paul Sanford. I thought he was very eloquent and did a very good job. But again, a lot of this is politically motivated, in my view. But
let me just say,
sure.
Because I think that one of the reasons people lose their trials, and you have to decide: do you want to win the trial, or do you want to make a political speech?
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons they lose their trials is because they end up making political speeches and making accusations about motivation and maybe the ancestry of the officer. And and if you want to win the case, you don't say those things.
Right.
If you just want to make a speech and maybe embarrass somebody, get something off your chest, that's a great place to do it.
Right, or if you want to make a point to city council or to the community. And I think, it's important when I say that I think that, Joseph's decision was politically motivated, that's an after-the-fact decision. I wouldn't say that in court, but I would say it afterward, describing the decision, and I think you're completely right. We've been talking to Glenn Maurer, who's been handling a lot of homeless cases down in Santa Barbara and has been winning them pretty consistently, and now has done a significant record, hopefully it'll be a published record on January 19th, for the findings that the necessity defense specifically is not just usable, but effectively usable in cases around homelessness in Santa Barbara, and that the presence of a religious emergency shelter option which separates couples is not an acceptable alternative to folks who have found shelter in their vehicles. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Yes, there are two parts. One is that any type of temporary emergency shelter is not a reasonable alternative to a person who's got an RV. If that's really the only choice they have, and especially if that alternative is religiously based, and there's an objection to it.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add?
No, that's it.
Hey, you've done a yeoman's job here, Glenn, and thank you very much for spending an hour and a half away from work letting us know in Santa Cruz what's happening. Hang on the line for just a second.
Okay, Robert.
And that was Glenn Maurer. Santa Barbara about 2.5 weeks ago talking to me on the phone, and he's still at it. I received a copy of the decision of the Superior Court of the State of California in the case of the People versus David Ridley, and then, of course, the other case of Julie Cooper, I think it is. And, yeah, it's impressive to see this kind of stuff. Of course, there was a fine case at the appellate level in 1993 or 94, the Tobe case. And unfortunately, when it reached the California Supreme Court, they completely destroyed it. So it was a sad thing. But I think here we have a situation where nobody is appealing it, and it's going to stand, but it will not stand as a published case. It was not published, and so it's only law in Santa Barbara. But I think maybe it shows the way the wind is blowing, and I hope it does. I promised you Charlie Stevens, and I promised him an opportunity to speak, and I'm going to call him shortly. I got a very quick call, however, from a celebrity, and I have to put a celebrity ahead of Charlie, because though he's a celebrity in my book, this celebrity is, more au courant, so hang on, Charlie. This is, of course, Amy Courtney. You may know Amy. She's been on the show before. She is one of the two courageous people who, what did I call her, the bedsheet barricadista? I'm not quite sure, but she was one of the women who hung a bedsheet off the Highway 17 ramp above a Scotts Valley exit with a message about ending the war or questioning the war effort. And as her sheet was torn down quickly by the Scotts Valley police, she mounted a protest, and it's all covered in quite extensive detail in today's Good Times. It's called Speechless in Scotts Valley, and I think I like long stories about subjects that interest me and subjects I agree with, so naturally I would like the story by Laurel Chesky. But I think it's this kind of material in the Good Times is really a good sign for local weeklies, and I'm glad that we have this. What I'm going to do is very, very briefly contact Amy, who called during the taped portion of the show, and have her kind of give an update. Although a lot of the update, in fact, was given to Laurel Chesky. Let's see if we can get Amy on the line here. I hope we can get this phone to ring. It's a ringy-dinging here. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, in case you've forgotten. And
hello?
Is this Amy Courtney?
It is.
The traitorous Amy Courtney?
That's the one.
So, well, I've been introducing you. You can't hear the radio where you are.
Am I on air right now?
You are live on the air.
Hello, Santa Cruz.
Hey, and hello to you. I'm looking at the end of the story in the Good Times, which discusses your case, that your and Cassandra's case, I guess, against Caltrans and the Scotts Valley. Those are the two entities you're suing.
Right, Scotts Valley Police Department. And there's some particular defendants named in it, but, you know, they're associated with either the Scotts Valley Police Department or Caltrans.
Mm-hmm. And you heard this case was heard by Judge Ronald M. White last week?
He's the one, yeah. Last Friday we had our hearing at 9 o'clock in the San Jose Federal Court.
Did they strip you down before you went in?
No, but they do have a pretty, you know, rigorous little security search system. They made everybody take their shoes off. Somehow I got through pretty much harmless. I just walked through and I had nothing on me and just walked through and everything was fine. But everybody else that I was with, they made take their shoes off and, you know, the works. Like every little ponytail holders were going off and very high. They said they have new high sensitive, you know, security gates and whatnot.
So you snuck in the criminal treasonous banner and then you unfurled it in the courtroom?
Well, there was an American flag in the courtroom, so we were sort of contemplating an action, but we were unprepared without banner, imagine that.
But next time, let Judge White beware, eh?
That's right, exactly.
Actually, in a courtroom, we were just talking about this on the air in this interview in Santa Barbara, how it's important for defendants to kind of clarify the difference between political protests outside the courtroom and political protests inside. I mean, you can do it, but often, unless it's very well prepared for, you don't have much of an audience, the penalties are much more severe, it interferes with your purpose of getting free from the legal system and so forth.
Mm-hmm. pretty much guarantee alienating the judge against you in your case with that kind of thing.
Was the judge alienated against you to begin with?
No, actually. When we got there, there was a statement for each of the cases the judge was going to be hearing that day. And on our page, it said that there was no tentative ruling, but there were six questions that they wanted answered. And sort of, it's, you know, sort of like a pre, you know, get your mind thinking about this stuff, lawyers, before you come into the courtroom.
What were those six questions?
Exactly, I don't remember word for word, but every single one of those questions was directed at Caltrans, and it had something to do with what their policies were. And so they were not satisfied with the brief that the Caltrans attorney had turned in, laying out their defense, and he basically was asking him from the top, can you tell me again, what is your policy on flags hanging versus banners hanging? What is your policy in regards to the way that things need to